KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Mike Honig on KPFT Houston at 90.1 HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville at 91.9 HD2. KPFT is Houston's community media. On this show, we discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. I'm not going to spend a whole show on politics today. I think many of us need a bit of a reprieve. But I do want to spend time on some thoughts and a couple of stories before we do stuff that's just kind of interesting and maybe even fun. Post-election stuff. The first thing I'm going to read is an opinion piece by Michael Ian Black from thedailybeast.com. I think it's thoughtful and poignant, but also important. It's called, "Here's What I Learned from Trump's Victory. I'm the Problem. It's Me." Now, this is all written in first person, and that's the way I'm going to read it. Welp, I thought we were past this. I really did. I was wrong. For the last years, my Twitter feed has been filled with MAGA trolls telling me that people like me are the problem. I never believed them. At least I didn't until last night when my nation confirmed it. Turns out, people like me really are the problem. And I must admit, as Donald Trump begins the process of assuming his second presidency, that I don't know what to do about it. The thing is, people like me, Michael Ian Black, don't want to believe that half of my countrymen support the things Donald Trump supports. We thought 4 years of corruption, lies, ineptitude, graft, and cruelty cured our dalliance with our authoritarianism. Turns out the following 4 years of recovery only whetted their appetite. People like me believed that the office of the presidency would humble even the most hardened heart, just as it has for each of its previous occupants. Well, there might have been a couple of exceptions before Trump. We thought that even if a humbug were to assume the office, that the other two-thirds of the government would keep him in line. We thought even the most cynical politicians would put the nation's interests above their own. We were wrong. Because I don't understand how a nation founded in the highest aspirations of a people can choose to be led by somebody who only appeals to their basest desires. I don't understand how a nation that has fought so hard to overcome the worst of its sins can be led so easily back into temptation. What do my fellow Americans envision mass deportations are going to look like? A country that only 80 years ago locked 120,000 people into internment camps are now going to do the same to millions? This is what my fellow Americans just voted for. Unless they don't really believe he'll do it, in which case they're voting for somebody they believe is lying to them. Forgive me, I don't understand. America obviously wants to return to something. I wish I'd ever heard a cogent explanation of exactly what. But there was apparently a time of American greatness that was also somehow a time when the men were men, the women were happy, and in which, as Garrison Keillor so lovingly described his mystical town of Lake Wobegon, the children were above average. It is, in other words, a fiction. Worse, it's the fiction of a fiction, because that America loved its neighbors. This America spits on them. Or maybe, again, I'm just getting it all wrong. Speaking of Garrison Keillor, another disgraced octogenarian making a comeback, I remember when Trump won in 2016, and Keillor wrote, Democrats can spend 4 years raising heirloom tomatoes, meditating, reading Jane Austen, traveling around the country, tasting artisan beers, and let the Republicans build the wall and carry on the trade war with China, and deport the undocumented and deal with opioids, and we Democrats can go on for a long, brisk walk and smell the roses. I remember reading those words for the first time and feeling righteous indignation at them. How dare he, I thought, when he has the privilege to go read Jane Austen and smell his damned roses? 8 years later, I take his point. The world is going to keep spinning one way or the other, and there's not a damned thing people like me can do about it, not anymore. People like me feel foolish today, not because we lost an election, but because we put our faith in those stupid higher ideals that founded our nation. I know. Trump supporters will say the same, and both of us will believe that the other side misread those same stupid founding documents. But when I read the opening of the Constitution, I don't read it in the voice of Donald J. Trump. I hear it in the voices of my immigrant grandparents and great-grandparents, of my friends and neighbors and the people I interact with every day. What does it mean to Donald Trump to form a more perfect union? What does it mean to them? Are we more of a union today or less? People like me believe one way. We're wrong about everything else. I hope we're wrong about this, too. That was written by Michael Ian Black, and it was written, and so I read it in first person. The next thing I'm going to read is from the campaign of Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo, and I think it's good to hear at a time when it's easy to feel hopeless. Again, this is written in first person, and that's how I'm going to read it. From Lena Hidalgo, Harris County Judge. What a tough night. Like you, I'm disappointed after losing the presidency, key federal races, and several local elected offices. Vice President Harris and her team, along with all her supporters, her allies, and our Democratic Party, worked extremely hard and did our very best. The Vice President is a magnificent person and candidate. She makes us feel proud and inspired. It's easy to despair at the reality that her strength, thoughtful policies, and commitment to the community did not win the day. For me, Lena Hidalgo, as a woman leader, it's easy to despair at the seeming impossibility that voters will trust a woman to lead our nation. And it's easy to despair at the thought of what may come next, particularly as pertains to Donald Trump's authoritarian-like promises. Judge Hidalgo says, I decided to run for office when then-President Trump started attacking journalists and journalism itself, attacks on the free press being anathema to democracy. I believe democracy is our nation's biggest treasure. During this campaign, Donald Trump made very clear his authoritarian aspirations and his extreme agenda, including tariffs that would threaten the open market, anti-immigrant proposals that would leave our nation without vital workers, and a shakiness on Ukraine and Taiwan that would destabilize the international order. But my message is, don't despair. I do not believe those who voted for Mr. Trump did so because of his authoritarian wishes or the negative impacts of his extreme proposals, although I do believe there is still a gender barrier in politics. Perhaps they voted for him because they felt he would bring a stronger household economy and bring down inflation or better manage our borders. So what to do instead of despair? We should start with the reality that we have and work from there, with the resiliency and strength we know we have. We accept election results, of course, but that doesn't mean Donald Trump gets to be a dictator even for a day. We steel ourselves for our nation to be led by people we would not have chosen, but we fight bad policies through the court system, through public opinion, and the midterm elections. And throughout all that, and most importantly, we work to better connect with the many ordinary people who felt Donald Trump offered enough promise to outweigh his clear threats to our institutions. To everyone who voted, thank you for making your voice heard. I am always proud to lead our diverse Harris County. Onward, Lena. So what can this administration do before January 20th, and what can the Democratic-led Senate do before the end of the year? The President can exercise some of his powers as Chief Executive and Commander-in-Chief. As regards the Russia-Ukraine war, it's worth remembering that Russia has recently perpetrated two significant moves against the U.S. They caused dangerous devices to be shipped potentially on U.S. civil aircraft, and they sent fake bomb threats that interfered with voting by U.S. citizens. A response is absolutely called for, and it should be painful. A first consideration might be to preempt Ukraine being totally sold out by Donald Trump. This might be done by lifting restrictions on the use of American weapons by Ukraine, allowing them to fight with all the capabilities in their arsenal. Another possibility is to radically accelerate the transfer of weapons and ammunition to Ukraine before January 20th, and preferably before the end of the year. Another possibility is a response to Russia calling in North Korean troops to fight Ukraine, and in consultation with our NATO allies, might be to extend NATO air cover over at least parts of Ukraine. This doesn't have to mean NATO jets overflying Ukraine, but rather could involve anti-missile weapons fired from NATO territory. There may be other executive actions Biden can take before the end of his term, such as attempting to protect civil servants or protecting the Justice Department from executive interference, but it's unlikely that any such executive orders couldn't and wouldn't be reversed by Donald Trump on day one. There isn't much that a democratically controlled Senate can get passed into law, but job one should be confirming all Biden's nominees to open court seats. They can also make efforts that might at least act as political signals to the American public. For example, they can attempt to repeal the Comstock Act, which Republicans have made noises about using to further restrict women's health care. They can put forward a bill to reform the Supreme Court. They can present a bill for election reforms. Anything the Senate may pass will likely fail in the Republican-controlled House, but it's worth trying. In another vein, unfortunately, rightly or wrongly, I think it'll be a while before a woman heads the Democratic presidential ticket again, probably for a generation. Hillary Clinton, an extraordinarily qualified white woman, won the popular vote but lost the Electoral College. Kamala Harris, an extraordinarily qualified South Asian and black mixed-race woman, lost both the popular vote and the Electoral College, at least as of this writing. And it was white men and white women that made the difference. There's no telling what Democratic primary voters will do in the future, but I think that this history will factor into the choices of primary voters for a long time to come. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston, airing Thursdays at 6 p.m., Sundays at 1 p.m., and Wednesdays at 11 a.m. We excerpt most stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Shows and articles go back to May 2010, so you can also type keywords into the search bar. Shows now are at least 90% scripted, so you can visually scan episodes text if there is one particular topic in which you might be interested. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check our Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig and look for me on Threads and Twitter at Think Wing Radio. For the last political segment, I think, for this week's show, along the lines of my thoughts on Biden's executive choices regarding Ukraine assistance, there's this opinion piece from the Eurasian Times, which I have edited down a bit. It's called Joe Biden Could End the Ukraine War Before Donald Trump. Zelensky, too, might prefer a Biden-led deal. Trump has repeatedly said he could end the Russia-Ukraine war quickly, sometimes stretching credulity with his projected time frame in 24 hours, or even before his inauguration if elected. I'm not even sure that would be legal, but nonetheless. He has suggested that his approach would be more effective due to his personal good relationships with both Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Trump has also suggested that Zelensky should never have let the war start, implying that Ukraine could have made concessions to prevent the conflict. He has criticized Biden for allegedly instigating the war by providing military aid without pushing for a diplomatic solution. Trump's campaign has hinted at a policy where the U.S. might pressure Ukraine into negotiations, possibly involving territorial concessions to end the war swiftly. Following Trump's resounding electoral victory, Vice President-elect J.D. Vance outlined Trump's approach to peace in Ukraine. 1. A ceasefire based on the current lines of demarcation between Russia and Ukraine, creating a demilitarized zone along these lines. 2. Ukraine would remain outside of NATO, suggesting a policy of neutrality for Ukraine. 3. Ukraine might need to make territorial concessions, particularly regarding areas where there are significant Russian-speaking populations or where Russia has control, like Crimea and parts of the Donbas. And 4. European nations should take on more responsibility for supporting Ukraine, both financially and militarily, rather than relying heavily on the U.S. President Vladimir Putin's latest peace proposal to Ukraine, as outlined in various reports and statements up to late October 2024, laid down the following two conditions for engaging in peace talks with Ukraine. 1. Complete withdrawal by Ukrainian forces from the territories of Donetsk, Luhansk, and Kherson, and Zaporizhia regions. And 2. Ukraine must formally renounce its plans to join NATO. Putin stated that as soon as Ukraine agrees to withdraw from these regions and declares its intention to remain neutral, in other words, not join NATO, Russia would immediately order a ceasefire and start negotiations. I don't know what would be left to negotiate. The negotiations would cover international recognition of the new territorial realities and the lifting of all Western sanctions against Russia as part of any peace deal. When they were outlined, Ukraine and Western countries dismissed Putin's proposals, insisting that peace would require the full withdrawal of Russian forces from all Ukrainian territory, including Crimea, which voted to join Russia in 2014. Voted might be a little strong, but nonetheless. Story goes on. Trump's proposals are potentially more aligned with Russian interests than the current stance of Ukraine and its Western allies, who insist on the restoration of Ukraine's full territorial integrity and sovereignty before peace talks can proceed effectively. Coincidentally, Zelensky in his post-election congratulations appreciatively mentioned Trump's commitment to, quote, peace through strength approach, which is another way of describing Trump's isolationist or less interventionist approach. The Russian response to Trump's peace proposals has been muted. The Kremlin has indicated that any peace plan from the Trump administration would need to reflect the, quote, reality on the ground. Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesperson, has commented that while, one, Putin remains open to negotiations but Russian-U.S. relations are at their lowest point in history, two, the United States is now an unfriendly country involved in a war against Russia, and three, the U.S. is capable of changing its policy toward Ukraine, but it is impossible to end the conflict overnight. Negotiations for peace between Ukraine and Russia are likely to start in the next few months, most likely under President Trump. However, President Zelensky's congratulatory message to Trump hints at an acceptance of the changed realities. Consequently, negotiations could start even before Trump's inauguration as president on January 20, 2025. Zelensky may conclude that he'll be able to negotiate a better deal with Putin under Joe Biden than under Donald Trump. This scenario actually plays into my suggestions about Biden authorizing or threatening to authorize more equipment and weapons and greater latitude for their usage to Ukraine. This could provide leverage for a Russia-Ukraine deal negotiated by Biden, but why wouldn't Putin wait for Trump to be sworn in? Because if Biden gave such authorization for Ukraine far enough in advance, even Trump would have a hard time rolling back the new facts on the ground. Could such a deal between Ukraine and Russia be struck before January 20th? It would definitely be a long shot, but it might be worth considering. It's also worth remembering that the Europeans have a lot at stake here, and appeasing Putin's hunger for Ukrainian territory as the price for peace might remind them too much of the 1938 Munich Agreement that ceded chunks of Czechoslovakia to Nazi Germany in a vain attempt to avoid a European war. Could Europe continue to sufficiently support Ukraine in its war against Russia without meaningful U.S. participation? It's hard to say. Aside from the sheer expense, Europe's defense industries have atrophied more even than the U.S., and we're having trouble keeping up with Ukraine's needs even with European help. These sorts of questions are among the reasons I'm so concerned about these election results. Geopolitically, I can see this as the beginning of the end of the American century and American world dominance. I know some people might think that's great. I'm not among them. That's more than just ego or national pride. It has implications for war, peace, U.S. national security, our economic health and prosperity, and more. Our geopolitical recovery from Trump's first term in office was hard enough. It was aided by much of the Western world wanting us to come back into world affairs in a meaningful way. What the wreckage of our global influence will look like by January 2029 at the end of Trump's second term, or Vance's first, I shudder to think. As an aside, there's a related story that I'm referencing with a link, but I'm not going to read it. NATO's Ruta says Russian attacks on Europe are intensifying. There's also a Reuters story, no new limits on Ukraine's use of U.S. arms if North Korea joins Russia's fight, Pentagon says. To summarize briefly, while the U.S. statement says there will be no new limits on Ukraine's use of U.S. arms, the story doesn't make clear whether or not that means that existing limits won't be extended. Perhaps this is a case of deliberate ambiguity, but I wish the intent of what can only be construed as a threat was made more clearly and less ambiguously. Now it's time for health-related stories. We're getting away from the political thing, so take a deep breath. On the topic of women's health, I don't think you'll be hearing this story anywhere else. I ran across a post on Threads. Satanic Temple has created a largely free telehealth clinic to help people perform a ritual that includes mailing them abortion pills. This is from Threads. "Okay, this is honestly fracking amazing," the post says. "The Satanic Temple has created a largely free telehealth clinic to help people perform a ritual aimed at removing guilt as well as general self-affirmation that includes mailing them abortion pills. They're arguing that they fall under a religious exemption and thus can provide abortions via telehealth. Honestly, using religious exemptions to bypass religion-inspired laws is perfect." According to the website, the Satanic Temple is the first telehealth clinic providing free religious medication abortion care. Patients only pay for their medications from a pharmacy, which typically costs around $90. How it works: they'll text you a link to a confidential health screening. After completing the screening, you'll receive a link to schedule your virtual appointment. You'll video chat with their provider, receive an email from their pharmacy partner to complete your medication purchase, receive your abortion medication within 3 to 5 days in a discreet package, and then text the TST, the Satanic Temple, if you need support or have questions. TST health services are available to those who meet the following criteria. Here's where you get to the fine print: at least 17 years old, in New Mexico or Virginia at the time of the online visit, have a New Mexico or Virginia mailing address, be up to 11 weeks pregnant, medically eligible, interested in performing TST's abortion ritual, or be a TST member. Now, I did email the Satanic Temple to see if membership waives the restrictive state membership requirement and opens it up to anyone in the 50 states and associated territories, but from their FAQ, I don't think it does. Note that the Satanic Temple is not to be confused with the Church of Satan. They are antipathetic to each other. It is important to note that discussing this story is not an endorsement of the Satanic Temple. I have linked to their website. Our next health story is from thebusinessinsider.com. Walking pneumonia is spreading. Doctors share the telltale symptoms to look for and varied ways to treat it. A common infection known as walking pneumonia has been on an uptick across the U.S. in recent months, especially among kids and teens. The respiratory illness caused by Mycoplasma pneumoniae bacteria is often called walking pneumonia because it tends to be milder than other lung infections. Patients may feel run down with a cough and a slight fever, but are often still well enough to continue their daily life. I once had it, actually. It took me a couple of weeks to even realize it. Says Dr. Elizabeth Schlaudecker, Medical Director of Infectious Diseases at Cincinnati Children's Hospital, it can be a little incognito. It can sneak up on people. The illness can be tough to identify and expensive to test for, and it can linger for several weeks, making it a frustrating sickness for families. Plus, treatment isn't necessarily one size fits all. Here's what to know about how to spot it and treat it. Look out for persistent cough, fever, and fatigue. The telltale signs of walking pneumonia are not obvious. Illnesses caused by Mycoplasma pneumoniae tend to be milder than infections caused by the more common bacterial pneumonia, Streptococcus pneumoniae. ER Dr. Russell Magita at Seattle Children's Hospital says it's hard to know exactly how many of the patients he sees have walking pneumonia cases versus strep pneumonia or viral pneumonia. Often doctors use a stethoscope to listen for a characteristic localized crackling noise in patients with walking pneumonia, but not every patient has that. Testing for the bacteria that causes walking pneumonia is also expensive, relatively new, imperfect, and may not be covered by insurance, Magita said, so it's hard for experts to know exactly how bad this fall outbreak really is compared to years past. The latest CDC data on the tests that are being done suggests more toddlers are getting walking pneumonia this year than was thought to be typical. The illness used to be viewed as more common in school-age kids. There have also been outbreaks among young adults living in dorms where the bacteria has plenty of time to incubate and spread. Schlottecker is part of the CDC surveillance network testing patients for Mycoplasma bacteria across the country. She said test results indicate a surge in infections peaked in late August and early September as kids headed back to school and started trading germs again. Hopefully, she said, it's starting to slowly decline, but we're definitely still seeing it. People who have recently had the flu are also at increased risk for developing walking pneumonia. New studies suggest there isn't always a clear winner when it comes to the best treatment for walking pneumonia. Even though macrolide antibiotics like azithromycin are the recommended treatment and should perform better than penicillin-based antibiotics like amoxicillin on this bacteria, there isn't great data on which medication actually helps shorten and improve the course of this infectious disease best. In practice, Magida says doctors often use a mix of their own experience, local disease trends, and a particular patient's history and preferences to get a sense of what might work. In some cases, patients will get better without medication, but for bacterial pneumonia, an antibiotic can help. Doctors assess the situation on a case-by-case basis, similar to how they would treat an ear infection. He said, empiric treatment is what we do in most cases for most pediatric infections because it's hard to say for sure what's causing it. If you're not getting better on your first antibiotic in 2 or 3 days, then get seen again, he says. Doctors say even though walking pneumonia doesn't tend to be as severe as other seasonal illnesses kids pass around, like the flu, COVID, or RSV, it can still be a burdensome one for families because it tends to last for a long time. And please note this part, I will say. In rare cases, walking pneumonia can prompt brain swelling, kidney issues, and difficulty breathing, and people with lung issues and weakened immune systems may be especially at risk of hospitalization with walking pneumonia. In other words, don't automatically think it's okay to save a doctor's visit and just hope it'll go away on its own. It can get serious. Continuing, earlier this year, Dr. Schlottecker's 15-year-old daughter had a persistent cough that continued for a week after what her mom thought was just a cold. They went to see her pediatrician, who listened to the girl's chest with a stethoscope. Without any testing, the daughter was diagnosed with walking pneumonia and prescribed a Z-pack of azithromycin. Within 24 hours of beginning her medication, the teenager felt great again. Schlottecker said she was like, wow, this is so cool that we figured out what it was and got on the right drug. It was a good medical success story. Along that same vein, there's a story from CBSNews.com. Do I have COVID, the flu, or something else? 2024 symptoms and testing to know. As the weather changes, we can start feeling under the weather too, but while each illness has a typical set of symptoms, it's important to understand you can't diagnose on your own, said Dr. Celine Gounder, CBS News medical contributor and editor-at-large for public health at KFF Health News, said on CBS Mornings Wednesday. If you come in with these with some symptoms of cough or sore throat or runny nose, whatever it is, she said, I can't tell you if that's a cold, if it's walking pneumonia, if it's COVID or the flu. You do need to test, she said. But the good news is tests are available. Gounder said, since the pandemic, we now have tests that cover all the most common viral and bacterial respiratory infections, making it easy to test for all with one swab. Determining your exact illness through testing also helps decide on the best course of treatment. Gounder said, we have specific treatments for influenza like Tamiflu and Xofluza, COVID, Paxlovid, and walking pneumonia, azithromycin, as well as other infections, and testing helps guide that treatment, she added. Now, signs of COVID 2024, the COVID variant called XEC, making headlines in 2024, was spotted around the world and in half of the states across the U.S. last month. But a spokesperson for the CDC said the agency is, quote, not aware of any specific symptoms associated with XEC or any other circulating or co-circulating SARS-CoV-2 lineage, unquote. While symptoms can vary depending on vaccination status, those with COVID can expect symptoms including but not limited to cough, congestion or runny nose, diarrhea, fever or chills, shortness of breath, loss of taste or smell, sore throat, and fatigue. Americans are now eligible for free COVID test kits mailed to their homes. According to covidtests.gov, U.S. households will be able to order up to 4 free COVID-19 nasal swab tests through the federal program. COVID versus flu symptoms. According to the CDC, flu symptoms often include fever, cough, sore throat, runny or stuffy nose, body aches, headache, and fatigue. Some people may have vomiting and diarrhea, though this is more common in children than adults. The CDC adds, quote, "It's important to note that not everyone with flu will have a fever, and others may feel feverish or have chills. Flu signs and symptoms usually come on suddenly," unquote. Earlier this month, the Food and Drug Administration authorized Heilgen Scientific's RapidCheck COVID-19 flu A and B antigen test for home use without a prescription. There is a link in the article, which makes it easier for people to simultaneously test themselves for COVID-19 and the flu on their own. This is helpful because some of the symptoms are the same, the CDC reiterates, meaning you, quote, cannot tell the difference between flu and COVID-19 by symptoms alone, unquote. Unlike flu symptoms, the onset of cold symptoms is usually gradual, according to the CDC, and can include runny nose or nasal congestion, cough, sneezing, sore throat, headache, and mild body aches. Compared to the flu, fever is rare, but low-grade fevers can also occur, usually in older children and adults. The CDC adds, quote, "The signs and symptoms of a cold usually peak within 2 to 3 days of infection," unquote. Colds and flu aren't the only illnesses to be aware of this season. Walking pneumonia, for example, is on the rise among young kids. The number of 2 to 4 year olds diagnosed after visiting the ER for pneumonia-related illnesses has jumped from 1% to 7% in the last months, according to the CDC. Walking pneumonia, known scientifically as Mycoplasma pneumonia, is a kind of bacterial pneumonia that includes symptoms such as sore throat, chest pain, and fever in younger kids, Gounder said. She added, quote, "We do sometimes see vomiting and diarrhea, which are a little atypical," unquote. Whooping cough is also up among school-aged kids, with about 4 times as many cases this year compared to last year. The illness is especially dangerous for infants and young kids because of their small airways, CBS News chief medical correspondent Dr. John LaPook recently explained on CBS Mornings Plus. Quote, "The reason why it's called whooping cough, it's cough, 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 and then they gasp for air. That's the whoop. And as an adult, when you get it, you may be sick, but probably going to be okay in terms of moving air in and out of your body. With infants, airways are so small they can really have trouble breathing at all," unquote. RSV, or respiratory syncytial virus, affects the upper respiratory, that's why RSV, affects the upper respiratory system with a runny or stuffy nose, as well as a cough or sore throat. When the virus moves to the lower airways in the bronchi or the lungs, pneumonia or bronchitis can develop, which can be more dangerous. Most adults recover from RSV within 1 to 2 weeks, but children and infants are affected differently because of their smaller airways and underdeveloped immune systems. Testing is also important here since, quote, "There is no way to know if it is RSV, COVID, or the flu based off the symptoms alone," Gounder had said previously. There is no at-home RSV test available, but a pediatrician can test children through a nasal swab. There's also a relevant audio clip from the CBS News story that I'm going to play because it touches on another important detail.
CBS News medical contributor Dr. Selene Gounder, editor-at-large for public health at KFF Health News, is here. Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm good. Good morning.
All right. So why is it called walking pneumonia as opposed to your typical pneumonia that we're familiar with?
Right. So we call this walking pneumonia because you're generally less sick. So you're walking around. You're not laid up in the hospital bed,
sense.
Right? And so the symptoms are relatively milder than what you might see with other kinds of pneumonia.
And what are these symptoms that we should be looking out for?
Yeah, with walking pneumonia, what we scientifically call Mycoplasma pneumonia, it's a kind of bacterial pneumonia. You might see sore throat, chest pain, fever. In younger kids, we do sometimes see vomiting and diarrhea, which are a little bit atypical.
Mm. And why the increase in kids?
So what we think has happened is with social distancing during the pandemic, we reduced a lot of things to almost zero, like the flu, RSV, other kinds of infections. And so what we're seeing is now a rebound as these different infections start circulating again. And little kids in particular have not been exposed to these things before. So they're all being exposed all at once.
So an important note that's in the Associated Story audio but not in the text is that the increase in communicable diseases is largely due to the ending of social distancing. Now, my personal experience was getting 3 vaccine updates recently, COVID, flu, and Tdap, which includes tetanus and diphtheria, as well as whooping cough, which I don't think I've had boosted since elementary school. I did have some flu-like reaction about 17 hours later in the form of shivering like I had a fever, but it passed in a few hours. At my age of 73, I will need a second COVID boost in about 6 months. Hopefully, RFK Jr. will still permit that. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston 90.1 HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville at 91.9 HD2. KPFT is Houston's community media. You can also hear the show live online from anywhere in the world at kpft.org or listen anytime at archive.kpft.org for previous episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. KPFT is Houston's community media, and we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied homegrown programming. You can show your support for Think Wing Radio and KPFT by going to kpft.org and hitting the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. Pick Think Wing Radio and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between, and tell people about KPFT and your favorite shows, because spreading the word helps us too, and it's free. From the category of you never know where the next big antibiotic breakthrough might come from BusinessInsider.com, our toothbrushes are home to hundreds of new viruses. They could be the future of biotech. The next big breakthrough in disease-fighting innovation could be no further away than your bathroom. A recent study found hundreds of viruses on samples from toothbrushes and showerheads, including many that have never been seen before, let alone examined. But this specific kind of viruses, known as bacteriophage, aren't concerning for human health because they target and infect bacteria, not us, according to Erica Hartman, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northwestern University who led the study. Understanding how these infectious particles work could be a valuable step in protecting us from harmful pathogens and bacteria, including those that cause tuberculosis and other serious illnesses. Miriam Warman, a professor of biology at William Paterson University of New Jersey, who was not involved with the study, told Business Insider, quote, "The more we know about what's in showerheads and what's on toothbrushes with regard to viruses and microbes, the more we can advance in understanding how we get sick and even devise new tools to fight those pathogens," unquote. Researchers from Northwestern University were inspired to investigate toothbrushes because of a previous study investigating whether flushing the toilet could release aerosols that might contaminate a toothbrush left out on the countertop. The good news is that the study, nicknamed Operation Potty Mouth, found no evidence of poop-related germs on toothbrushes. "Overwhelmingly, they said, we found that microbes on your toothbrush come from your mouth," said Hartman. The research team decided to put all those used toothbrushes to good use and took a closer look at what's hanging out there. In a previous study, they also analyzed samples taken from shower heads to offer even more insight into our bathroom's microscopic occupants. The researchers weren't surprised to find that these household items were home to many germs because of their warm, moist environments, but they were blown away by how many different kinds of viruses were present. There was so much diversity that there was almost no overlap between the samples, meaning each toothbrush and showerhead was host to its own unique microscopic world. Phages could be the new frontier in disease-fighting biotech. "There's no reason to be grossed out by the tiny inhabitants sharing our homes," said Hartman, quote, "I don't think there's any need to change behavior or enhance cleaning. These are not viruses that are going to infect you. These are viruses that are potentially cool," unquote. It's a common misconception to think of all germs and microorganisms as potential threats, but plenty of microbes are neutral, beneficial, and sometimes necessary for human health. Bacteria and viruses have sparked groundbreaking innovations in science, biotechnology, and healthcare that we benefit from every day, such as penicillin and DNA research. Phages are exciting because they specialize in attacking and replicating inside bacteria, including bacterial pathogens. These pathogens make us sick and can become resistant to our current protective strategies like antibiotics. Warman said, quote, "They are potentially a very helpful tool for us," unquote. Researchers have known about the existence of phages for more than a century, but antibiotics have gotten most of our attention. Now that some pathogens have outsmarted antibiotics, phages are a wide-open frontier for innovation. In the future, phages might be a rich source of biotech innovations like phage therapy, in the same way pharmaceuticals have developed medicines from plants or animals. Rather than scouring remote reaches of the planet, these discoveries could come from digging deeper into what surrounds us every day. Hartman said, quote, "There are a lot of things waiting to be discovered just under our noses or on our toothbrushes," unquote. I might observe this is why preserving life on Earth from the macrobiological to the microbiological is really important. It's not just that life has a value of its own. Even for the materially minded, it's worth remembering that we never know what animals, plants, or microbes might hold the key to the next medical or biomechanical breakthrough. Even Velcro came from studying a seed pod. I think our next story is pretty interesting. It's from phys.org. Evolutionary anthropologist presents hypothesis about why humans are dominating the world over other animals. Why is human culture, the shared body of knowledge passed down across generations, so much more powerful than animal cultures? What's special about our species is a question scientists have wrestled with for centuries. And now a scientist at Arizona State University has a new hypothesis that could change the way we perceive ourselves and the world around us. Said evolutionary anthropologist Thomas Morgan in a new research paper published in Nature Human Behavior, quote, 10 years ago it was basically accepted that it was the ability of human culture to accumulate and evolve that made us special. But new discoveries about animal behavior are challenging these ideas and forcing us to rethink what makes our cultures and us as a species unique, unquote. Morgan is a research scientist with the Institute of Human Origins and associate professor with the School of Human Evolution and Social Change. Just as humans pass on knowledge to our children, when a new queen leafcutter ant hatches, she collects a little mouthful of her mother's fungus and takes it with her to start a new colony. This has been happening for so long, millions of years, that the fungus within these colonies is genetically different from the wild fungus outside of the colonies. Similar to how human languages change, new data shows that humpback whale songs evolve, spread between groups, and become more complex over time. Like humans, chimpanzees learn to use tools, and we now have evidence that they've been doing so for thousands and perhaps millions of years. Even locusts use complex evolving systems to adapt to local conditions, relying on epigenetic changes, how factors like age and environment can change gene activity without altering the DNA sequence to quickly evolve between calm and green, or swarming and yellow and black forms based on overpopulation. These discoveries, along with others, have shown that not only do animals have culture, but there are also examples of accumulation in their culture, something that for a long time was believed to be uniquely human. Said Morgan, quote, "It used to be thought that other species just didn't have culture, and now we know that lots of species do. Then it was thought that only human cultures accumulate or evolve over time, but now we know animal cultures can do this too. So if animals do have evolving cultures, then what's special about human culture that differentiates us from animals?" Morgan and Stanford University professor Marcus Feldman address this question in their paper, "Human Culture is Uniquely Open-Ended, Not Uniquely Cumulative." They present a new hypothesis that we humans dominate and are so special because of open-endedness, our ability to communicate and understand an infinite number of possibilities in life. Said Morgan, quote, "The way that animals think about what they're doing constrains the way that their cultures can evolve. One way might be that they can't imagine elaborate sequences very easily, or they can't imagine sub-goals. For example," Morgan says, quote, "when I'm making my boys breakfast in the morning, it's a nested multi-step process. First, I need to get the bowls and pots and other equipment. Then I need to put the ingredients in the pot and start cooking, all in the right amounts and order. Then I need to cook it, stirring and monitoring temperature until it reaches the right consistency, and then I need to serve it up," he said. "Each of these steps," he went on, "is a sub-goal, and these sub-goals have steps within them that I need to execute in the right order, so this whole thing is an elaborate procedure," unquote. When it comes to the limit of this system, human brains just keep going. We're able to build and retain sequences of instructions that are deeply complicated, and this allows us to perform a near infinite set of behaviors. This is open-endedness. While other scientists have compared human and animal cultures before, Morgan and Feldman's research is unusual because it compares animal examples of epigenetic inheritance and parental effects. The leafcutter ant is an example of a parental effect, and the locust is an example of a cumulative epigenetic inheritance. While both epigenetic inheritance and parental effects are stable and accumulate in non-human species, they eventually stop developing, explains Norman. Quote, just like animal cultures, there are constraints that these systems run up against and that halt their evolution, unquote. Morgan went on to say, quote, I think the key question is what is special about human culture? And we tried to answer that by comparing human cultures with animal cultures, with epigenetics, and with parental effects, as many evolving systems as we could think of. And in the end, we concluded that the special thing about human culture is its open-endedness. It can accumulate, but then it never has to stop. It just keeps going. I found the first sentence in this story particularly interesting because many animal and human behaviorists hate to use the word culture in regard to animals because of the implications of intelligence or personhood that word might bestow. And yet, when an adult chimpanzee teaches a young chimp how to open a nut for food by using a rock as a hammer with another rock as an anvil, isn't that culture? If in the absence of this lesson the young chimp doesn't learn this tool-using trick, it may not discover it on its own. If that's not culture, what is? And yet there are many examples of this kind of passed-down learning among many animals. The story discusses two animals of insects, no less. What are some other implications of this research? Well, it actually has a bearing on the effects of habitat loss on the survival of species. Much like humans, there is some exchange of culture among groups of tribes of animals. When habitat is broken up and communications among groups are cut, some animals may lose the ability to pass on survival skills to new generations. If you think about it, this is the same as trying to release an animal habituated to a human environment back out into the wild without rehabilitating them, which is to say, helping them learn the skills they need to survive. Does that not qualify as a sort of acculturation that animals require to thrive in the wild? Humans have spent millennia looking at animals as chattel or tools, or as Alfred Hitchcock is said to have referred to as extras, scenery that moves. Considering animals as having more cultural capacity than that has big implications that will be challenging to cope with by human civilization. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston, airing Thursdays at 6 p.m., Sundays at 1 p.m., and Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central. You can also hear the show by visiting archive.kpft.org for episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. We excerpt most stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station, catch up with your favorite shows on the archive, and help KPFT keep the lights on by clicking the donate button. You can also donate by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738 extension 1. That's 713-526-5738 extension 1, and you may even qualify for a lovely thank you gift. Just ask. You can send us your thoughts about our show by emailing thinkwingradio@msn.com. We're also on Facebook at Thinkwing Radio with Mike Honig, and I'm on Threads and Twitter at Thinkwing Radio. Now a read the contract story where both sides might need to better understand their contract. This is from Jalopnik.com. Hertz apologizes for threatening to have customer who drove 25,000 miles in a rental car arrested. Hertz is in a heap of public relations trouble once again as a location manager threatened to have a customer arrested if he didn't pay a $10,000 mileage overage charge for driving 25,000 miles in 1 month. That's a ton of miles for a car to rack up in 1 month, basically doing around 1,000 miles per business day. But here's the kicker. The rental agreement was for unlimited miles. In the TikTok video that's embedded in the actual story and first spotted by a user 1 mile at a time, you can see the exchange between the Hertz manager and the unnamed customer become quite heated. Despite repeated pleas for sanity, the customer is faced with a choice of paying the $10,000 and walking out, or continuing to dispute the charge and potentially getting arrested. It isn't clear what laws the customer was breaking that would result in their arrest, but when a so-called customer service professional becomes this belligerent, there's likely no reasoning with them. There are obviously two sides to this story, as the customer almost certainly overran the car's service intervals during this month with the machine. If they were ignoring service engine light soon lights on the dash, that could certainly have caused untold damage, maybe even above the $10,000 fee. That said, it's in Hertz's best interest to make this PR nightmare go away as quickly as possible, so it has decided to reverse the charge and apologize to the customer. Hertz's statement provided to The Drive reads, quote, Customer satisfaction is our top priority at Hertz, and we sincerely regret this customer's experience at one of our franchise locations. Making sure they point out it's a franchise location. Continuing, per the terms of the contract, the customer will not be billed for mileage. Our franchisee is addressing the employee's conduct and reinforcing our customer service standards and policies to ensure they are understood and followed consistently across our locations, unquote. So I guess if you need to do a whole lot of driving over the course of a month, you should probably rent a car so you aren't racking up miles on your own vehicle. Maybe make sure you get the rental desk to confirm it's unlimited in writing before you take off, though. Now, I think the reason the customer could potentially be arrested, which is a legitimate question, would be for creating a disturbance, and having been asked to leave private property and refusing to do so could now be considered as trespassing. But I think the story author made a couple of interesting points. First, there's the black letter contract. Unless there are some qualifiers or limits to unlimited mileage, then the mileage is unlimited. Second, there's at least one service interval that was likely exceeded before 25,000 miles, and that would be the oil change interval. In all likelihood, the contract cited customer abuse and failing to take ordinary care of the vehicle as a violation of the rental agreement. Further, damage to a rental vehicle is the renter's responsibility. Did a service light go on? No way to know from this story. But exceeding a service interval without notifying the lessor that the lessee could make the lessee rather liable for engine damages. Even insurance would not cover user abuse. All in all, I think this qualifies as news you can use. For our next story from Futurism.com, Boeing reportedly looking to sell off its disastrous Starliner spacecraft. Embattled aerospace giant Boeing is reportedly looking to sell off its space business following the disastrous crewed test launch of its much-maligned Starliner that left two NASA astronauts stranded in space. As the Wall Street Journal reports, insider sources claim that Boeing is looking to get out of the space race altogether in the face of a deepening financial crisis, a startling about-face for a company that's worked on iconic space vehicles ranging from NASA's Space Shuttle to the International Space Station. The embattled contractor even approached Jeff Bezos's Blue Origin, per the Wall Street Journal's reporting, which has been working on its own rockets for NASA. Despite a decade of development, Boeing has yet to successfully deliver and return astronauts on board its Starliner capsule, a damning indictment of a company that already has several major fires to put out. In other words, it shouldn't come as a surprise that Boeing is looking to cut its losses, but buyer beware. Boeing has been burning through billions of dollars as its commercial jet business continues to grapple with concerning quality control issues and an ongoing industrial worker strike, just recently settled, of epic proportions. Earlier this month, Reuters reported that was in October, that Boeing is set to fire 10% of its workforce, amounting to a staggering 17,000 employees. And Starliner, its entry into NASA's commercial crew program, hasn't fared any better. The capsule left the International Space Station last month without any passengers on board due to a nagging technical issue that NASA deemed too dangerous for a crewed return. According to its latest filings with regulators, the company took another massive $250 million loss on its Starliner commercial program in its third fiscal year quarter, bringing the total losses of the spacecraft's development to a stunning $1.85 billion. NASA also recently announced that an upcoming crew rotation flight to the ISS would make use of SpaceX's Crew Dragon instead of Starliner. Despite looking for a buyer for Starliner, Boeing is reportedly still committed to overseeing the development of NASA's Space Launch System rocket, which is set to deliver the first astronauts to the surface of the moon in over half a century, no earlier than 2 years from now. Nonetheless, NASA's Inspector General concluded in a damning August report that Boeing's contributions were woefully behind schedule and way over budget. In short, Boeing's recently minted CEO, Kelly Ortberg, now has the seemingly impossible task of picking up the pieces and ditching the parts of the business that are weighing down a company actively involved in the crisis. Ortberg told analysts during a call a couple of weeks ago, quote, "We're better off doing less and doing it better than doing more and not doing it well. What we want this company to look like 5 and 10 years from now? And do these things add value to the company or distract us?" Unquote. This isn't good for Boeing or the U.S. We really need at least two ways to get to orbit, and with SpaceX being the only current viable U.S. alternative, we're back in a bind of sorts. And frankly, Boeing hasn't been doing great on the space launch system that's one of the essential pieces for returning to the moon. It's years late and billions over budget. Let's hope that things will pan out so we can still beat the Chinese and Russians back to the moon, because if they get there first, there's always the danger that they'll see possession as 9/10 of the law. And last, I just want to play an audio clip that represents a kind of dark election humor. It's MSNBC's Chris Matthews having his mind blown when Trump was declared the winner in 2016, and it's amazing how relevant and accurate his comments still is now.
I've always counted on, and our democracy, our basic notion of democracy, I guess, as it's modernly practiced, is that skill in winning the presidency would be applicable to being president. We thought we saw this with Roosevelt, with everybody since in the modern media, or since Teddy Roosevelt, that if you have the equipment to win a presidential election, to put it together, to figure out what you need to do to win it, to be entrepreneurial enough to create this enterprise and then win with it, that that would be the best way to pick the best president. And so here we are with a guy who's done it in a totally perhaps awful way. Right. And my determination to be optimistic is to try to say, to try to figure, is the talent he showed, call it talent, to do what he's done in the worst way, stirring up hatred, and all the other things in terms of identifying markets, finding out there's a market for anti-trade feelings, there's a market for anti-immigration, there's a market for stupid wars, and putting all that together into sort of a bouquet of politics, and then to somehow find a way to do it electorally. I mean, I got a call from them last night from Kellyanne. Are they going to carry Pennsylvania? I'm not sure they did have a really sophisticated system.
Asking you.
They knew I knew the city. They knew I knew the area. But the fact that they were polling this sort of way, you know, one-to-one, what do you hear? That's pretty old time. I'm just going back to, I know we're going to disagree about some of these things, but I am just determined to find an optimistic notion here, which is there must be some talent here to be president, because he's going to be our president for 4 years. So if you take the view, he's terrible and he's going to fail miserably, so why don't I get ahead of the curve and say that first? That's not what I'm going to do. I'm going to wait and see the next couple of days and see, is he going to recoil everything he said, because it all was a game? All the class antagonism, the ethnic antagonism, which bothers me. Is he going to pull back from that? The attack on the media, all the stupid stuff. Is he going to say, well, that got me where I want to get, but I don't need that anymore. What I need now is calm, confidence-building measures that I can actually have a chance of building this economy back up again. Because the reason I believe in the infrastructure thing, and I know he has to get it financed, he's going to have to change the Democratic Party. The Republican Party is going to have to help the Democratic Party. But do the brains that got this guy elected president tonight apply to being a good president? I leave it as an open question. I hope there's some connection. Otherwise, we have a dingbat as president. We have a guy with no ability to be president. It's hopeless, with terrible values and incompetence galore. And we're just into doomsday right now. I'm just not ready to accept that sort of notion right now in my head. I have to think there's got to be a pony in this crap pile.
And there we have another example of how history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it rhymes. That's all we have time for. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston 90.1 HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and our new improved Huntsville repeater at 91.9 HD2. We are Houston's community media. I hope you've enjoyed the show and found it interesting, and I look forward to sharing this time with you again next week. You all take care.
Let's keep on looking for the light. Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside.
Well, if you are an animal lover, then BARC, the City of Houston's Animal Shelter and Adoption Center, would love to get to know you better for two reasons. First, for fostering, as fostering changes lives. And there's many different options within fostering, but with every kind of fostering, the goal is the same: to help every foster animal become adoptable and to find a forever home. To learn more about the life-saving act of fostering, shoot an email to barkfoster@houstontx.gov. The second thing to know about BARC is the large number of adorable animals looking for their forever homes. BARC's Adoption Center is open from noon to 5 p.m., Tuesdays through Sunday, and is located at 3300 Carr Street, which is near 59 and Collinsworth. So if adoption or fostering works for your household lifestyle, please seek out more information at houstonbark.com.
Hi, this is Marina Rocks, and you're listening to KPFT Houston.
One way to take a break from the news about COVID-19 is to listen to the music on KPFT. If you're holding back on making a donation because it's not the right time, you can always donate a vehicle you no longer need. Pickup is free, and the sale could mean hundreds of dollars of support. Learn more at kpft.org or call to donate your car to 1-855-KPFT-CAR. That's 1-855-KPFT-CAR.